In partnership with NPR Illinois, the World Affairs Council of Central Illinois presents Trump and the World Economy with Dr. Stephen Livingston.
Dr. Livingston is the Associate Director of the Business and Economic Research Center and also Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University. And tonight he's going to address the World Affairs Council on the vital topic, Trump and the World Economy. Let's give him an appreciative welcome.
And so tonight I want to talk, as you know, about Donald Trump's foreign economic policy. I'm sure people are not used to talking about Donald Trump much, so I'll try to move gingerly through the topic. But here's what I plan to do. I want to talk, of course, the issue I really want to talk about, because to the Trump administration, policy on the world economy is trade policy, okay? And so what I want to do is talk about the kind of the structure, the setting the scene of American trade policy. And then I want to talk about the Trump trade policy, which is dramatically different from any U.S. trade policy, maybe forever, but certainly since the 1920s. And then I want to talk a little bit about whether I think the change of policy is going to be successful. And I'll give anybody a spoiler alert that wants one. I'll give you 3 seconds to put your earplugs in. I really don't think it's going to accomplish what President Trump hopes it will. Okay? So that's how I've got things set out here. And if there was a slide, if there was a first slide, the first slide would be an odd one because it would be a title from a Wall Street Journal, page one, about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And it was about a new record in the level of consumer debt in the United States. And I was going to say, do people believe the speaker is confused? Isn't the topic supposed to be about trade? What's this slide up on debt, consumer debt? And here's where I want to go. If you are talking about the structure of world trade, let's just start with a kind of an imaginary situation. And the situation is there's two people in the world, okay? There's you and there's me. That's it. Now that means that in this world, everything that's made, we make, and everything that is consumed, we consume, right? Now let's imagine in this world that for whatever reason, I want to consume more than I make. Okay, now how am I going to do that? Well, there's only one way, and that's I got to get some stuff from you because I've consumed everything I made, now I want more. Okay? So if we started doing statistics on this world, started looking at trade flows and the flow of money, what are we going to see? We're going to see a flow of money from me to you and a flow of trade from you to me. Right? You're going to export to me, and I am going to pay you, or actually at first I gotta get a loan from you, so there's like multiple transactions going here. But that is a fundamental underlying feature of trade on any level, between people, between American states, you know, you name it, between companies. The individual that saves more ships to the person that's saving less. The person that consumes more is importing from the person that saves more. Okay, that is just a fundamental reality. And that is a bedrock. There's no way to overturn that. Okay, if I consume more than I produce, there's no way I can export more than I import. Right? I'm already consuming more than everything I make, so I can't do that. And when you are thinking about trade, it's a relatively simple point, but you don't hear it that often. And that is trade deficits go to countries that have low savings rates. And they flow from countries that have high savings rates. And so my little slide was the American consumer, you know, you gotta love them, but man, do they buy stuff. Right? The United States has a pretty low savings rate. And then we can throw in government deficits. I'm assuming I don't need to tell anybody that the United States has the capacity to rack up massive government deficits and has done so for decades. I had a slide, the next slide, see, I'm going to do it 100,000 words at a time. I had a slide that showed the American federal government deficit as a percentage of the American economy and the American trade deficit as a size of the American economy. You can lay one on top of the other, and there they match. Right? And I had a third slide. Now I'll stop talking about my slides, okay? But I had a third slide, and the last time the United States ran a trade surplus was back in the 70s. The last time it ran a current account surplus, which is a little bit different, but it's basically a trade surplus, was 1981. And you can do a little chart, and I had a little chart, and guess what happened in 1981? The United States net savings rate dips below zero. And then it drops. Okay? And so that's a reality that's going to underline everything I say, because if you don't tackle that problem, you're not going to tackle a trade deficit. Now, there's a different argument about how big a deal the trade deficit is, but that's not. We can talk about that in Q&A, I guess, if you want. But that's not really what I'm addressing now. America's first great trade deficits occurred in the late 1980s. And guess what was happening in the 1980s with the federal government deficit? You know, I mean, that's when the government deficits first started ballooning. Okay? For the last few years, the trade deficit has been bad but stable. And that's because the government deficit's been bad but stable. So, any policy that doesn't tackle the difference in savings rates is not really going to be effective. Now, it can be effective at the margin, because of course there's other things going on. I mean, yes, there is unfair trade, there are currency manipulations and so forth. But the bedrock is, you can't really make a society that spends a lot and saves little a massive exporter. Okay, and I'm just going to remind you, I mean, who is the biggest export company in the world? Not company. Who is the biggest exporting country in the world by the number of people? It's Germany. Okay, what country massively runs huge surpluses both at the private level and at the government level? Well, Germany. Okay, I mean, that's just the way it works. Now, the trade deficit became a political issue in the late 70s and especially in the 80s because of this big explosion in the deficit. And we had four presidents since then, right? Two Bushes, a Clinton, and an Obama, who attempted to tackle the American trade situation without fundamentally dealing with the difference in savings rates. And maybe that's something for us to get into. I mean, it's a politically very difficult thing to tackle. And instead, they went at it a different way. And I want to briefly describe that way, because that's the way that President Trump has decided not to go. Okay? And so the Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama policy kind of had three legs. It was a stool with three legs. And the first leg was to try to ramp up exports from individual American companies. And this is the era, you know, the 1980s, is the era when presidents first started going on international trips with a bunch of CEOs in tow to make trade deals. Okay, and this is when all kinds of public programs begin to try to assist small and medium companies to start exporting more. And so the idea was, we can solve this, or try to solve this trade deficit by encouraging exports. I'm gonna go into that too deeply, but you know, you're trying to solve a huge macro problem with little micro events, and that doesn't usually work. And it didn't really work in this case. Either. I mean, individual companies probably got help, but the big picture, no. You know, the big picture wasn't really helped by any of this. And so two further pillars got constructed, or legs to the stool, or whatever. And the first one of those was a movement to create this international organization, the World Trade Organization. Now, you may know that there was a trade treaty going back into the 40s, General Agreement, which had been the auspices for gigantic trade negotiations. By the 90s, the United States, which was the leading country in the creation of the WTO, came to believe that an organization like the WTO would help the U.S. with its trade deficit. Because, first off, it would force other countries to deal with new issues that they didn't want to deal with, like trade and services, which the United States is quite good at. And also, and this was a fundamental thing, it would create a sort of court system where the United States could actually go and get action on countries that were trading unfairly. Right? So the WTO does have they don't call it a court system, an arbitration system, where country A can bring a case against country B for trading unfairly. And it goes through a court procedure, and there is a decision. And the beauty of the process is the losing country legally can't retaliate, which is the way you used to do it, right? If country one attacked country two of trading unfairly and did something, country two said, no, we're not trading unfairly and we're gonna do this back, right? Those of you who are have been around for a while might remember the poultry wars between the European community and the United States in the early 60s. And I mean, that's the way it used to be done, right? So the U.S. was trying to stop that. They wanted to force countries that were dealing unfairly in trade matters to change their policies. And if you look, this has been actually used vigorously by the United States, okay? The United States has brought way many more cases at the WTO than it brought against the United States. And it's got a reasonably good track record of winning those cases. And once again, it's important. I mean, it's important to the individual firm, to the individual industry. But if you're looking at the big picture, the whole United States, I believe there have been, well, there's been 300 and some odd cases. Okay, I can't remember the exact number at the WTO. I mean, that's not enough to fundamentally change a trade deficit in the United States of $500 billion a year. Right, that's just an extremely big number to get through all kinds of unfair trade actions, even if you win them all. And remember, other countries go after the U.S. and they win too. I mean, it's not the United States is not a country that engages in no unfair trade. Right, we'd like to think that, but that's just not true. So that was the second stool, the WTO. Well, the WTO didn't really solve the problem. And so there was the third stool that was created, and everybody calls these things free trade agreements. That's a misnomer because they're not really free trade. I mean, they're preferential trade agreements or something where there are very large agreements made with one or a group of countries to expand trade with those countries. Of course, most famous one is NAFTA, but the U.S. is in a number of them. Okay, and the thinking here was, okay, the WTO is not moving fast enough, so this is kind of like a coalition of the willing thing. We will move even faster with those countries that want to decrease or lower trade barriers with us, and this will solve the trade deficit, okay? And, you know, the same thing. Again, lots of individual firms or industries may have been helped. Some probably were hurt by these agreements, but they simply couldn't overcome the fundamental problem, which was the difference in savings rates. And so, yeah, Bush number one, Clinton, Bush number two, Obama, if we were going to evaluate the success of their presidencies based on their ability to solve the trade deficit, well, none of them succeeded, right? The trade deficit was just there, and it would move up when American debt moved up, and it moved down when American debt moved down. So that is the structure of the situation that Donald Trump confronted when he became president, you know, getting close to a year ago, okay? And so what I wanted to do, and maybe without the slides, I don't know if it's as colorful or not, but before I started talking about the Trump policies, I thought I might introduce you to the Trump team, Because some of them don't get the, you know, there are certain names that you just can't stop hearing about. And we don't hear so much about some of the key figures in the administration in terms of trade policy. But so you won't be able to see their pictures, but I could tell you a little bit about the key players and their beliefs, okay? Because their beliefs are not exactly the same. And I can start with President Trump himself. And what I want to note about President Trump is people accuse him, correctly in some cases, of flip-flopping a lot on the issues over the span of his life. That he's been pro-choice, anti-choice, that sort of a thing. When it comes to trade, you cannot accuse him of flip-flopping. He has been opposed to free trade for as long as he's been a public figure. You can go back to the 1980s and you can read editorials written by Donald Trump, and those editorials sound very much like Donald Trump today. Very opposed to free trade. Okay, so the man is consistent on the issue, and it seems to be a very important issue to him. I can only resort to news information on this, but it's said that at almost every meeting involving the international economy, he brings up trade. It's something that's very important to him. I really don't know why. It's kind of odd of why someone in real estate, which is a non-tradable, would become so concerned about trade. But I mean, I guess that's neither here nor there, right? He is. There's three other people I want to point out who are kind of the chief architects along with, with Donald. I mean, I guess the way I put it maybe is Donald Trump has the big picture, but somebody else has to come up with the details. And so there's a couple of people that are doing that. And they've got one minor difference, but I want to point it out because American press doesn't cover this stuff very well, but the Canadian press has made a big deal about these differences, so I might note it. The president's chief trade, strategist, is the Secretary of Commerce, who is a man named Wilbur Ross, who is a friend of Donald Trump. I'm not sure how long, but a longstanding friend of Wilbur Ross. And like Donald Trump, Wilbur Ross is really focused, I mean, I would almost say fixated with bilateral trade balances. The current international system is structured that, a country should balance its trade, okay? But it's not expected that you balance trade with every single country. Some countries you'll run surpluses with, some you'll run deficits with, but it will balance. But Ross's view, and I believe Trump's view, is that's an incorrect way of thinking, and the correct way of thinking is the United States needs to have a zero balance, or maybe a positive balance, they could live with that, but a zero balance with every major trade partner. So it's not a multilateral vision, it's a bilateral vision, right? It isn't the U.S. and the world, it's the U.S. and the U.K., the U.S. and Mexico, the U.S. and Japan, and that's the vision, okay? And Ross is also very forward that in negotiations, you should expect the stronger party to get the better deal. It's like a business. And so his argument is the United States, if you have one-on-one negotiations with all these countries, you're always going to be the stronger and you ought to always get the best deal. Okay, so multilateral is not good. You should be moving towards these situations where you have the power and you can get that other side to do what it has to do so that you get this balance. And if you have read his commentary about the NAFTA negotiations, he says every single time he doesn't understand why Canada and Mexico aren't retreating because they have so much more to lose. It'd be a catastrophe for Mexico to lose the U.S. market. So that's the vision, is that you solve problems by bilateralizing them, and then you use your power to drive home the deal that's going to solve the problem with that individual country. Okay. So that's probably the most important person. Now according to the Canadian's rival, you don't get this in the U.S. press. So who knows who's got the facts here, the Canadians or the Americans? But a man named Robert Lighthizer is the U.S. Special Trade Representative, which is traditionally America's, I shouldn't say traditionally, but since the early 60s, the United States chief trade negotiator. Okay, apparently he and Ross fought bitterly over who would handle the NAFTA negotiations, and Lighthizer won. Lighthizer is opposed to free trade, so I mean, he's still on the same page, but he's not fixated with the bilateral issue. His issue is free is simply, it's more, I don't want to say ideological because that sounds bad, but he's just against free trade. Okay? Multilateral, bilateral, doesn't make any difference. He really thinks that free trade is an excuse for other countries to take advantage of the U.S. And so the way you should handle it is just by dropping free trade. I mean, it's just drop the rhetoric, you know, stop pretending, and move to a kind of policy that's better for the U.S. And as a matter of fact, when I had these guys' pictures, I had a little quote underneath them all. And the quote I picked out for a Lighthizer is he quote unquote mocked my, not my words, mocked people who believe that you should obey international trade law as if it was a religious or moral duty. Okay, so that's his perspective. Okay, it's not a world of law, it's a world of negotiated power. Okay. And then the third person that I wanted to bring up, who is buried right now, but may rise again, because if you've been reading the press, his boss is apparently soon to be expelled or leave the administration, is a man named Peter Navarro, who is an academic economist from California. And the difference in his perspective is he's totally focused on China. And he believes that China is, its trade policy is a mortal threat to the United States, and the United States really has to do whatever it can to stop China in its tracks. Okay, so he's not really so concerned with other countries, and just remind you, probably, you guys probably already know this, but more than half of the U.S. trade deficit is with China, right? It's a very concentrated deficit. Okay, so that's the personalities that are making this policy. They're all pretty much on the same page, but they do have some differences between them. Okay, so what's their view? I mean, what do they share? And their basic view is, for four administrations running at least, the United States has been making the same mistake over and over again, and that mistake is lousy negotiators. That the United States has been signing trade treaties, beginning with, first of all, they don't really get on the U.S.-Canada free trade agreement too much, but with NAFTA and the WTO and the treaty with South Korea, with these various treaties, the United States has given away the farm. It's incompetent negotiating, and that is the fundamental issue, is bad negotiating and unwillingness to stand up for American firms that are the subject of unfair trade policies by other countries. Okay, that's it. So what's the solution, if that's what your view is? Well, it's pretty simple. Of those three legs I was talking about, one of those legs, which is bringing a lot of actions against other countries, that one you pump up. Right, you do more to help American exporters. The other two legs you get rid of. Okay, so you dismantle the free trade agreements, and they are softer about WTO, but I'll try to argue that if you just look at what they're doing and what Wilbur Ross says, they are not, I guess their view is if the WTO changes so that it works with America, that's great, but otherwise, it's time to move on, right? It's time to just let the WTO die. Okay, so that's a strategy. Now, how are they trying to implement this strategy? And I've got a number of points here, and this isn't really implementing, but one thing that maybe shows the sincerity of the view is that, as you may know, throughout this year, the United States has refused to sign communiques at international meetings that either commit countries to oppose protectionism, or which argue to support multilateral trade. It was a G20 meeting that tried to put I shouldn't say tried, because there's been one in every G20 meeting forever. A clause that said that the countries in the G20 are committed to preventing the rise of protectionism. The United States refused to sign that and did not. And then at the APEC meeting a few months ago, the Asian Pacific Economic Conference, the United States refused to sign the statement of that communique because it said that it endorsed the multilateral trading order. Okay, so first off, there's been this rhetorical turnabout. But then the basic thinking is, okay, what we need to do is we need to move to a system where every deal is negotiated like a business with hard business negotiations, and the fundamental principle is reciprocity. That is, we get everything we give, and they don't get anything more. Okay, and I've got a couple quotes if I can find them fast enough. Donald Trump, reciprocal is, if you've got a 30% tariff, you know what? We should have a 30% tariff. That was said to the G7. And Wilbur Ross, if we have a country that has big trade barriers against us, we should have similar big trade barriers against them. Okay, so the view is reciprocity. And we may be able to do this more in Q&A than in my talk. I mean, the thing is, it sounds great. Reciprocity sounds great. In a multilateral world, it's really hard to pull off. Okay, so maybe we can get to that when we get to it. Okay, so the vision is we are going to move very hard on unfair trade, and we are going to deploy negotiators like the world has never seen to drive home bargains that finally really help American exporters. Okay, so let me look at the first stage, which is to really go after unfair trade. The administration has ramped up dramatically the number of trade actions taken against other countries. 50%. This is only the first year, right? The first year of the administration, trade actions are up 50%. Now, what's interesting is how they're doing it. Three differences from the previous administrations. First difference, the Trump administration is deploying something called a self-initiated trade action. Most U.S. trade law, the way it works is if there's a company or maybe an industry organization that believes that another firm in another country or another country is trading unfairly, they go, the U.S. trade law is so massive and complex, usually you got several paths, okay, but you take one of these paths and you bring a case. Right, you go to the International Trade Commission or somewhere and you bring a case, and then the International Trade Commission examines it, and if they think that you've got a case, then it goes to higher up, ultimately to the president for a decision. The Trump administration is letting companies do that, but it's also initiating cases on its own. Okay, the steel case, aluminum foil, both were initiated by the Trump administration. So that's the first difference. The second difference is the parts of U.S. trade law that the Trump administration is using. They are using parts of trade law that are, depending on how you want to interpret them, vast in terms of what kinds of unfair trade policies can be raised against them. To give you two examples, the United States is now using, I'm sorry for the technicality here, I guess, but there's something called Section 232 of a trade act that was passed in 1962 that allows the United States to impose trade barriers, protectionism, for cases involving national security. And until this year, exactly twice has that been used. It was used when the hostages were taken in Iran, and it was used after the Lockerbie bombing against Libya. Okay, the United States has already brought several cases under the Section 232. And again, Secretary Ross has said, this is a quote, "National security is much broader than what you might think." Okay, so that's the first track. The second track is, there is a later trade law, 1971, and there's a section of that trade law that allows the president to impose trade barriers if an industry is in serious decline. And that is also a very seldom used aspect of American trade law, because it is the kind of thing that's going to invite retaliation on the other side. Because, I mean, who's to say what decline means, you know? But again, it's the same thing, that the Trump administration has actively used this. Another big case that I want to talk about in a second, well, maybe more in a second, is a case on solar panels, and that was brought under the argument that the American industry was in decline. And so it was permissible to block imports that would threaten this industry. Okay, the third difference is the previous administrations went multilateral with the trade complaints. After the WTO came into existence, they went to the WTO, and they used the WTO judicial process to go after other countries. Okay, and the thinking was first off, they wanted to strengthen the WTO, but the other thinking was, if you win a case to the WTO, there's nothing the loser can do, right? They've lost the case. They can't retaliate. Whereas if you do it, U.S. domestic law doesn't mean a thing to the rest of the world. It's U.S. law, it's not international law. Okay, so it's an interesting strategic move. And I would argue the move is intentional. And it is because there's a desire to move things out of the WTO. And they're prepared to risk potential retaliation by other countries to achieve a weaker WTO. Okay, so that would be my my argument there. Okay, so that is the first thing they are doing, which is a real ramp up under new, I shouldn't say new, formerly little used aspects of international trade law to try to restrict imports into the United States, okay? The second thing that they are doing is they wish to dramatically increase, you know, one thing about trade, it can get pretty boring pretty fast. There's a lot of terms and rules out there. In a lot of trade agreements, especially free trade agreements, there's something called rules of origin. And rules of origin, you know, if you're thinking, think about NAFTA for a second, okay? There's free trade between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, all right? What is the definition of a Mexican good? You know, what is it? Does it have to be 100% made in Mexico? What if it's 80% made? You know, what if it's 70% made? How do you know? So that's got to be in the treaty. What's the definition of where something is made? And that's called the rules of origin, okay? And the Trump administration, they want to raise the rules of origin in these treaties to make it more difficult to make things outside the United States and put them in the U.S. Okay, so for example, the current NAFTA treaty has a rules of origin of 62.5% of the value of a product has to be Canadian, American, or Mexican. Okay? The Trump administration wants to make that 82.5% and 50% American. Okay, so that's the difference. And you know, the thinking is that's going to force people back into the U.S., right, manufacturers, because it'll just be too onerous to move goods into the U.S. with those kinds of rules of origin. So, okay, so that's the second aspect. Third aspect is the one that gets most of the press these days, and that is to either get rid of the existing free trade agreements or turn them into the more bilateral zero trade deficit agreements desired by the administration. Donald Trump in September you may have seen this in the news, actually did ask his aides to write him an executive order for the U.S. to pull out of the U.S.-South Korean Free Trade Agreement. And he was talked out of it by his advisors, so that hasn't happened. Presumably it's sitting in a drawer somewhere to be pulled out whenever necessary. But then there's the NAFTA negotiations, which is absorbing a huge amount of attention and effort. And what's going on in the NAFTA negotiations? Some of it is updating the treaty, which is a good thing. I mean, NAFTA was 1994, NAFTA's been ratified in 95, so it's got, you know, it's pre-digital, it's pre-internet. Some of it is things that I think most people would think were a good idea to press on. You may know that Canada, for example, has a very protected dairy sector. Nothing wrong with pushing Canada on that. But the three things that are arousing controversy are this rules of origin change, which Mexico and Canada don't like for obvious reasons. Secondly, it is putting a 5-year sunset on the treaty. So NAFTA will, no matter what the outcome of the negotiations, will go out of existence in 5 years unless it's re-ratified. And then the third thing is NAFTA has arbitration panels. There's something like the WTO in them, where a business can bring an action against one of the countries claiming that they are being treated unfairly. And the Trump administration wants to get rid of those, right? So in a certain way, they want to gut the multilateral parts of the treaty and turn it into more of a bilateral treaty. I guess it's not technically bilateral because there's three countries, but you know, more of a bilateral type setting. Okay, and as you may know, these negotiations were supposed to end at the end of the year. Now they pushed it to the end of March. They are apparently going well for the non-controversial things, updating the treaty. There's no movement at all on these more controversial things the U.S. wants. So in a few months, we will see what the Bush administration is going to do, right? Whether they will just continue to say something's going to happen and parlay this out, or whether they actually will try to pull out a NAFTA. Kind of interesting because we have an election in 2018 that's going to have to play into that decision too, and when it will happen. So that's the third thing. The fourth thing they are doing is they are beginning to take action to create this world of bilateral treaties that they think should supplant the current system. And they are targeting two countries, well, they were targeting three, the UK, Japan, and sort of China. They never put China in this context, but Secretary Ross has said that he would like the first treaty to be with the UK. And you may, a few weeks ago, I mean, he instructed the UK, didn't go over well, that in their Brexit talks, they should make sure not to give way on certain things because it would make it more difficult to create this bilateral treaty with the U.S. They have also talked a little bit with Japan about it. Japan right now, it doesn't seem like that's the direction they want to go, but that's the second. The Trump administration pressed, they had negotiations going for months with China, which ended last week. It ended because nothing was happening. Okay, there just wasn't any movement. And so the talks ended. Last thing that the Trump administration is doing, I told you before, they tend not to be fans of the WTO. They think it was poorly negotiated. They think it gets in the way, which it does. If you want a whole series of bilateral trade treaties, the WTO gets in the way because fundamental principles of international trade law are countries have to be treated the same. And obviously, you can't have a series of bilateral deals and keep that. Okay, so there is an understanding, and Wilbur Ross has said it in interviews, that there's an understanding that what the U.S. wants clashes with what the WTO has, and that's going to be an issue at some point. But what the U.S. is doing right now is the appellate court of the WTO has seven people on it, or it should have seven people on it. And there are, right now, there are three vacancies. And the United States has blocked the appointment of any new appellate justices. So I don't really know what happens when you go down to three. I haven't read the WTO treaty close enough to know how, if a minority of justices can render valid decisions or not. But the Trump administration says, and I don't, it says, look, this is not what's going on. We're not doing this on purpose. We're doing this because they're not good candidates, and we're really disappointed with what's going on with these decisions. So I don't want to, put words in their mouth, but if just from the outside looking in, it's a little strange that they're unable to find anybody to replace on this on the WTO appellate body. And so I would say that it is an expression of a skepticism about the WTO and a preference that it not be the center of U.S. trade policy. Okay, so that's what they're doing. And that lets me turn to my third part of what I wanted to talk about, and that's what's going to happen. Okay, now I already told you what's going to happen. It's not going to work. It's not going to work because the savings rates aren't changing. And there was an interesting interview in the Wall Street Journal with Wilbur Ross. It was about 10 days ago, it wasn't very long ago. And Paul Gigo, who was, many of you may know because he's been on TV a bazillion times, asked Wilbur Ross point blank. He said, isn't this trade bill more important to the American trade deficit than any trade policy you're pursuing? And Ross's answer was totally off the subject. And I thought, what does this mean? Does this mean he accepts the point, but it's not, he doesn't really want to address it? Or does it mean he doesn't really accept the point? I don't know. But Gigo was right, how the U.S. savings rate is affected by the tax bill 10 years from now is going to have a bigger effect on the U.S. trade deficit than anything Donald Trump can do. And I will quickly add, than anything that any previous president could have done had they been president when this tax bill was passed. Okay, I mean, it's just gonna overwhelm for positive or benefit, or for negative or positive, okay? But it's gonna overwhelm any of the policies that are undertaken, these little tiny little trade policies to solve a $500 billion hole. Okay, but let me get specific why I don't think it's gonna work. I think there's some analytic weaknesses, I'll put it that way, in the thinking about trade. And the first problem, I think, to use a just really stupid analogy, you know whack-a-mole, right? You hit a mole and it just pops up someplace else. And you've also got putting a square peg in a round hole. If you could combine those two things and visualize it, you're going to see the problem I'm talking about, which is, for better or worse, the trade system is multilateral. And you might wish it was bilateral, but wishing something and getting something are two different things. And when I say it, imagine if we had a United States where every state was supposed to have a zero balance with every other state. I mean, it would be crazy. Imagine a system where I had to have zero balance with everybody I dealt with. I mean, I would like that with my mortgage company, but I probably wouldn't like that with my employer, right? I mean, we live in a multilateral world. Money's coming in and it's going out to different actors. And what you're hoping is it balances out at the end. And so, I mean, imagine the U.S. is, how are you gonna get? Tell me the treaty that's going to balance trade between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Okay, I mean, you could put a clause in there. We guarantee we'll never buy any oil from Saudi Arabia. I guess you could do that. But, I mean, good luck. But, I mean, to flip it on the other side, one of the countries that is always on the wonderful fair trade list is the Netherlands, because the United States always runs a trade surplus with the Netherlands. Is this because the Netherlands is an unusually free trade country? No, it's because the port of Rotterdam is the major site of U.S. exports into Europe. So as a statistical matter, the Netherlands looks fantastic. So how are you going to deal with that in a treaty? Okay, it's coming up with a whole series of bilateral agreements that's going to somehow balance all that. I mean, you're getting into a Soviet-type micromanaged economy where every country is told how much it can sell, how much it can buy. American farmers would have to be told, you can import this much from this country, you can import that, you know. It's a totally different system than the one we have now, and I just do not see it, that it's going to be realized. And on top of that, let's imagine he started realizing it. Let's say the United States signs a treaty with, I don't know, Thailand. Okay, and so you are a company in Thailand, and you find that you can't import into the U.S. because there's some kind of barrier. Well, are you just going to sit down and take it? Or are you going to move to Vietnam and sell out of Vietnam? So then the U.S. has to go to Vietnam and sign a treaty. Okay, well, then you go to Laos. So then you got to go to Laos and sign a treaty. Right? I mean, it just escalates. Because for better or worse, companies can move. They're not countries. You know, you can move. You can move where you make something. Okay, so that's the first. It's a whack-a-mole problem. I mean, it's like, bah, we're going to stop you. Bam. And then they're over there doing the same. Doing the same thing. The second thing, which I guess I don't want to call a misunderstanding, but I think there's a misunderstanding about how difficult it is to do anything about. You know, a lot of us think of trade as country A makes something and they sell it to country B and they buy something, right? It's anybody that remembers David Ricardo, it was cloth for port. I mean, it was this thing for that thing. Well, that's totally unlike trade today. First off, more than 40%, for this is U.S. trade, more than 40% of U.S. trade is within the same company. Okay, so how do you stop that company? Is that really an unfair or fair trade issue that a company is moving product back and forth across boundaries? It's going to be much more difficult to deal with than a country that makes something. Okay, and related to that are supply chains. I'm sure we kind of all know about supply chains. In a great many sectors, products are not made in one country. There's little steps made everywhere, right? I mean, as I'm sure everybody knows, if you dismantled your car and tried to figure out where everything came from, I mean, my God, there's gonna be 10 countries in there, okay? And so it's the same deal. How do you handle products that are made like that? And the Trump administration knows that supply chains are a big issue, and they want to rip them up. That's the strategy to rip them up. But you got the same whack-a-mole problem. There's a statement from the American Alliance of Automotive Manufacturers. This is in part of the information that their lobbyists have given about the NAFTA negotiations. And they say if there's any serious effort to block the movement of automotive parts in from Mexico, they think most of their members will move to China, where the import tariffs are only 2.5%. Okay, so great, you got them out of Mexico, you know, now you gotta get them out of China, right? So that is supply chains are really difficult because they're not going to, you know, there's a reason why supply chains exist. They don't exist because there's a trade treaty. They exist because they make economic sense. And so you are having to do a lot of work to, you know, it's water going downhill and you're trying to reverse it. Right? Because believe me, automotive makers were moving into Mexico before NAFTA. And they're going to be there if they get rid of NAFTA. So then you got to do more work to get them out of NAFTA. Okay, it is a very serious problem to try to disrupt the supply chain. But then I want to look at a couple of specific examples of specific trade actions going on now to try to exemplify why this is really going to be hard. And I want to look at the solar panel case, and I want to look at aluminum foil. Two things we don't think about too much, unless you got a house, I guess you're trying to turn green or something. These are both cases that have gone through this past year, trade actions by the International Trade Commission or by the Trump administration. And in the first case, solar panels, The finding was that the United States should impose 35% tariffs on solar panels. Okay, for aluminum, the amount of aluminum tariffs is 97 to 127%, depending on the specific kind of aluminum. Okay, the administration has not announced the final decisions yet. And why is that? Well, let's look at these two industries and let's see what would happen if the tariffs were put on. Look at solar panels first. In the United States today, let me remind you something, there's 152 million jobs in the US. The solar panel industry today, there are two companies operating in America. One of them is Swedish. So maybe the goal is to make Sweden great again, 50-50. These two companies together employ less than 1,000 people. Okay, so that's who this trade action is for. The solar panel industry employs 288,000 people. These are the people who put parts on solar panels, who put the solar panels in the structures, who put the solar panels on the buildings, who are engaged in the logistics of moving, you know, all this stuff. And the solar panel industry claims that 88,000 jobs will be lost if these 35% tariffs are imposed, because it will, you know, raise the price 35%, I'm not being dense about it. Okay, and so you're looking at 88,000 jobs gone to get 1,000 jobs. The American Utility Association estimates that utility expenses will go up 30% and that consumer utility bills will go up 15%. Okay, I mean, because the problem here is it's not as if there's some massive amount of solar American solar panels that are sitting on a dock someplace, right? You're gonna have to buy them from overseas. I mean, a few of them, you can buy a few from these companies. And so what's gonna happen? Well, the price has to go up. Okay, so there's the case, it sounds, it's not improbable that China has been cheating on solar panels. I'm not trying to make this out like it's these poor Chinese, you know, and we stop picking on them. I'm just looking at what happens if the way you respond to this is to try to keep them out. What you're going to do when you've got a very small U.S. industry is just drive the price up, and you're going to make people lose their jobs when somebody decides, I can't afford a solar panel. You know, aluminum foil is kind of in the same situation. It's not, there are 70 aluminum foil manufacturers in the U.S., so that's a little better. They do employ 31,000 people, and that's 31,000 divided by 152 million, so it's really small, but it's the same. What the aluminum foil industry says is there's not the reason we are buying from overseas is there's not enough domestic production, and they have said, quote, we will have to turn to Spain, Indonesia, or Russia, because I mean you need aluminum foil. And if you can't buy it U.S., you will buy it from wherever you can get it. I will tell you something else, hopefully not making anybody mad at me, but Buy American's great. American products typically are very, very good. But when it comes to aluminum foil, 90% of the aluminum foil that's rejected is made by American plants. So it's just not always the case that swapping out production, and I say this, I mean, I'm reminding people of American cars in the 70s, right? I mean, there was a reason why international trade in automobiles happened at that time. Okay, so just to take a step back, so I'm saying, first off, trade's multilateral. It's gonna be really hard to tackle that bilaterally. Second off, supply chains, you may hate them, you may wish that they had never come about, and I suppose you could have stopped them in the 70s. But stopping them now, it's in the rearview mirror. It's going to be extremely difficult, and the pain that America will have to absorb to do that is going to be significant. The third thing is, I mean, you really got to wonder if the U.S. is prepared to move away from the WTO. That's a big decision. And you have to wonder, you really got to be able to be pretty confident that you're going to be successful in a world without laws to go ahead and make that move. The other things I want to raise and then turn it over to you guys is just some pragmatic things. You know, other countries have politics too. And it's an easy thing to say, we're bigger than you are. You need to understand you got to give on this. Because it's going to hurt you a lot worse than it's going to hurt us. Okay, I'm going to be really unfair for a second and say, that kind of reminds me of the argument about Vietnam. Right, we're big, they're little, we have to win. But in a system where another country has to go to its voters and say, well, we had to do all these things that are really bad, but this big bully made us, good luck in the next election to that party. You know, it's not gonna happen. And let me just give you some. The United States has asked several of its trading partners to start bilateral negotiations. Singapore, they refused. And the official memo said, this deal is only because the United States wishes to get a better deal for itself. We're not even gonna start. South Korea, South Korean government said, the United States, if it wishes to leave, we can live with that. We will attempt to withdraw first. Germany, we will not start talks, quote, just because they pursue a nationalist policy on the other side of the Atlantic. The EU has actually created a list of American exports to use to retaliate against the United States if they attempt to do anything. And one of the interesting things is they put on the list, one of them was bourbon, which is aimed at Mitch McConnell. You know, this kind of, they picked out who they want to hurt. And of course, last week, the United States and China, those talks came to a halt as well. Okay, and so then I don't want to pile on. So, but the last thing that I want to talk about is I think the confidence in one's negotiating ability is a great thing, and I actually have no doubt that Donald Trump and Wilbur Ross and these people are excellent negotiators. I mean, I would say they've shown it, but negotiating a trade deal is going to be hard because it's going to raise other issues that you cannot isolate from trade. And one of the biggest things is currency movements, right? The value of the dollar can easily undermine any trade negotiation. The Peterson Institute, which they're not a bunch of wackos, have studied what would happen if the U.S. ended all steel imports. They had predicted that if the dollar rose by 1% in reaction to that, it would wipe out total export gains by the Americans because of that action. Really, the only way that you could ensure a successful trade negotiation is if the U.S. engaged in currency manipulation, right? If it went in or outside of that treaty to set the dollar's value. And if the U.S. did that, that's the end of the international role for the dollar. And the cost of that would be immense for the United States. Okay, and I'll just leave you with, I forgot to put it, I didn't have my slide of Peter Navarro. Peter Navarro, I had a quote from him that said, hey, trade policy is not foreign policy. And I guess I would leave my little talk here by saying, I don't know if that's true. And just look at China and North Korea. I mean, can you really separate trade policy from foreign policy and negotiate a bitter trade deal with a country and then turn around and ask them for help on the North Korean nuclear program or anything else? Okay? So I think I've probably gone on long enough, and it might be more interesting to talk than to hear